There is this rather lazy young man in his mid-20s. All he did is lay around the house. Wouldn't work. Wouldn't do anything for his family. Wouldn't help out around the house. His mother, who struggled to raise him as a single parent, came home one afternoon. He's got a beer on the end table, and he's kicked back in his underwear watching television. And she says, "You're no good. You're lazy. You need to do something. You need to become something. Do something with your life. Jesus is watching you." He goes, "Mom, you and this church stuff, I don't care what Jesus says." She says, "No, you better, because your day's coming. There's going to be a reckoning." Well, this young guy didn't have any idea to go to work. Because what he did, he would go into rich families' homes at night, break in, and steal whatever he could get out in his little bag. That was what he did. And he had no intention of going to work and becoming anything other than just basically a thief. Well, this one house that he had scoped out, he snuck around the back. He knew the people were gone on Wednesday night. If they were church people, they were probably going to Bible study. So he snuck around the back and he smashed in the window, reached in, unlocked it, got his bag and his flashlight, and he's walking in, he's looking around. He works his way to the dining room. He sees a big chest of drawers on the next to the wall, and he opens up a drawer and he sees the silver, so he starts to scoop it out to put it in his bag, and he hears this voice. "Jesus is watching you." He looks around with his flashlight, can't see anything. "I'm hearing things. My mother's voice is ringing in my ears. Jesus is watching me." So he gets into the drawer again, takes out some more stuff, and again the voice says, "Jesus is watching you. I'm warning you, Jesus is watching you." Takes a flash over in the corner, there's a birdcage and there's a parrot there, and he walks over and he says, "Are you saying that?" The parrot goes, "Yes, I'm just here to warn you, Jesus is watching you. And he's going to get you." He says, "What's your name?" The parrot says, "Moses." Well, what kind of a person would be stupid enough to name their parrot Moses? The same people that were stupid enough to name their guard Rottweiler Jesus. It's funny. Maybe a little sacrilegious. But Jesus Christ is watching us. He's watching over us. What did he tell his disciples? And it was penned in the book of Hebrews. Turn to Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5. "Let your conduct be without covetousness and be content with such things as you have. For he himself," Jesus Christ himself, "said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear what man can do to me." And compare that with what it says in Genesis chapter 28. Genesis chapter 28. God speaking to patriarch Jacob. Genesis 28 verse 15. "Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you." So God said to Jacob that he was going to be with him. Jesus said in the New Testament, he won't leave us or forsake us. And I'm going to hammer this home for a few verses. So turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 31. Deuteronomy chapter 31, starting in verse 6. Says, "Be strong and of good courage. Do not fear nor be afraid of them, for the Eternal your God, he is the one that goes with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you." So God adds a little extra caveat to this. Not only is he not going to leave us, he's not going to forsake us, but he asks us to be strong and of good courage. Verse 7, it says, "Then Moses called Joshua and said to him in the sight of Deuteronomy 31. Then Moses called Joshua and said to him in sight of all of Israel, be strong and of good courage, for you must go with this people to the land which the Eternal has sworn to their fathers to give them, and you shall cause them to inherit it. And the Eternal, he is the one who goes before you. He will be with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. Do not fear nor be dismayed." Then over in the book of Joshua, chapter 1. Joshua, chapter 1, starting in verse 5. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and of good courage, for to this people shall you divide as an inheritance the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous. Now, strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand nor to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. Verse 8, this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, that you may observe to do all according that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you, be strong and of good courage? Do not be afraid, nor be dismayed, for the Eternal your God is with you wherever you go. And as Mr. Close brought out in the sermonette, we have to obey. And sometimes we don't think about this. God says He won't leave us. He won't forsake us. Because of the situation with Miss Lemon and my daughter, I did a little study on healing during this last week. And every time when it says that God will heal us, that He'll do this, it involves obedience. So sometimes if we ever wonder why God isn't so quick to heal all the time, this is an aside, this wasn't in my notes, but it just dawned on me, according to what he had said too, that you need to understand that these blessings from God are intertwined with obedience to what God wants us to do. Turn over to the book of 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 12, starting in verse 20. Then Samuel said to the people, "Do not fear. You have done all this wickedness." What was the wickedness that Israel had done during that time? They rejected God as their ruler. They didn't want Samuel to have say over them. They looked around them and they saw the pageantry of the kings and the armies and the military might of the nations around them. They said they want to be like these nations. So Samuel said, "Listen, you've done this wickedness, but yet do not turn aside from following the Eternal, but serve the Eternal with all your heart. And do not turn aside, for then you would go after empty things, which cannot profit or deliver, for they are nothing." Verse 22, "For the Eternal will not forsake His people, for His great name's sake, because it has pleased the Eternal to make you His people." Verse 23, "Moreover, as for me," Samuel said, "far be it from me that I should sin against the Eternal in ceasing to pray for you, but I will teach you the good and right way. Only fear the Eternal and serve Him in truth with all your heart, for consider what great things He has done for you. But if you will do wickedly, you should be swept away, both you and your king." So if we stay in faith, if we obey God, if we do the things that are pleasing in God's sight, if we follow the Word and do what we see there, God won't forsake us. Over to the book of 1 Chronicles. 1 Chronicles, chapter 28, and verse 20. "And David said to his son Solomon, 'Be strong and of good courage, and do it.'" What's he telling him to do? To go ahead and finish the temple, to build the temple, because God said to David, "You're a bloody man, I'm not going to have you do that." But David procured the materials, he lined up the idea for the thing and took God's measurements and all of that so the temple could be built. But Solomon is the one God wanted to go ahead and finish the temple. It says, "Be strong and of good courage. Do it. Do not fear nor be dismayed. For the Eternal God, my God," David said, "will be with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you until you have finished all of the work of the service of the house of the Eternal." And then in verse 37 of Psalms. Psalm chapter 37, I'm sorry, chapter. Verse 25. Notice how many times in just a few books of the Bible where God promises that He won't leave us. He won't forsake us. And as Jesus said in the New Testament, He's not going to leave us or forsake us. Verse 25 of Psalm 37. I have been young, and now am old. Yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his descendants begging bread. He is ever merciful and lends, and his descendants are blessed. Depart from evil, and do good, and dwell forevermore. For the Eternal loves justice, and does not forsake his saints. So we stay in faith, do what God expects, and God won't forsake us. Man, you're confusing me. Isaiah chapter 49. If this isn't making sense, just pay attention a little longer. Isaiah chapter 49, starting in verse 1. He says, "Listen, O coastlands, to me, and take heed, you peoples from afar. The Eternal has called me from the womb. From the matrix of my mother, He has made mention of my name, and He has made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of His hand, He has hidden me, and made me a polished shaft. In His quiver has hidden me. And He said to me, 'You are my servant, O Israel, in whom I will be glorified.' Then I said, 'I have labored in vain. I have spent my strength for nothing and in vain. Yet surely my just reward is with the Eternal, and my work is with my God.'" Verse 5, "And now the Eternal says, 'Who formed me from the womb to be His servant, to bring Jacob back to Him so that Israel is gathered to Him? For I shall be glorious in the eyes of the Eternal, and my God shall be my strength. Indeed,' He says, 'it's too small a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved ones of Israel. I will also give you as a light to the Gentiles, that you should be my salvation to the ends of the earth. Thus says the Eternal, the Redeemer of Israel, their Holy One, to him whom man despises, to him whom the nation abhors, to the servant of rulers, kings shall see and arise. Princes also shall worship because of the Eternal who is faithful. The Holy One of Israel has chosen you. Thus says the Eternal, in an acceptable time I have heard you, and in a day of salvation I have helped you. I will preserve you and give you as a covenant to the people to restore the earth, to cause them to inherit the desolate heritages." God calls us to do a job. And when He calls us, He will back us. He will be with us. He won't forsake us. And then over at Isaiah chapter 41, verse 10. "Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Yes, I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand." And then in verse 17, it says, "When the poor and needy seek water, there is none, and their tongues fail for thirst. I, the Eternal, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them." I think this is something as the church, I think we overlook sometimes. I think when we go through trials and problems and things come upon, well, maybe I'm talking to somebody that's never had any trial. Well, we know Mr. Close had trials. But sometimes I think we overlook that God is just a prayer away. God is close and won't forsake us if we're obedient to Him. Turn to Malachi 3:6. Brethren, this isn't something that God just did to His prophets, that He did to the patriarchs in the Old Testament. God is available for us today. Malachi 3, verse 6 and 7. This is very familiar. I know we always look at Malachi 3:6. "For I am the Eternal, I do not change. Therefore, you sons of Jacob, not confused." But read on. "Yet from the days of your fathers, you have gone away from my ordinances and not kept them. Return to me, and I will return to you, says the Eternal Host. We need to have that as a banner before our eyes, that we need to be close to God, and God will be close to us. Turn over to Romans 8, chapter 8, verse 31. Another very familiar scripture. And we like to use it sometimes as a hammer, or when we want a quick little saying that if God's for us, who's against us? But let's read it and think about it. Romans 8, verse 31. What then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? Now you pay attention when I run out of water. He's going to leave me dry up here. I'm going to drink some water, so he's going to have a job to do. If I keep doing this, I'm going to need an intermission. Romans 8:31. If God is for us, who can be against us? God's got all the power of the universe. Who can be against us? God is all powerful. It doesn't matter who's against us. God can have the victory. We can have the victory through Him. Verse 32. He did not spare His own Son, but delivered Him up for us. For us all. How shall He not with Him also freely give us all things? Now, this doesn't necessarily mean a brand new Mercedes or a yacht, but all things that are good for us, all things that are necessary to enter life. It's God who justifies. Who is He who condemns? It's Christ who died and furthermore is also risen, who is even at the right hand of God, who also makes intercession for us. If God is for us, who can be against us? So how does God take care of us? How does God even know who we are? Turn over to the Psalms 139, verse 1. O Eternal, You have searched me and known me. You know my sitting down and my rising up. You understand my thought afar off. That can be disconcerting. My worst character is behind the wheel of a car. I don't know why it is. My granddaughter's kind of giggling. She'll ride with me to work. And I'm carrying on a two-way conversation with myself. What on earth is this guy thinking? Oh, you wanted to get ahead of me? Oh, wow. And I just want to scream. I know years ago people would say, oh, I wish I was a spirit being. I'd zap that car and blow it up and resurrect them right away and tell them what they did wrong. I was with somebody not too long ago that was doing that, and I was the passenger, and I'm thinking, you're the most atrocious driver I've ever been with, and you're blaming everybody else. But God knows our thoughts. You comprehend my path, verse 3, and my lying down, and you are acquainted with all my ways. There's not a word on my tongue, but behold, O Eternal, You know it altogether. God already knows what we're going to say. He knows what we're going to think. Verse 7, where can I go from Your Spirit, or where can I flee from Your presence? If I ascend into heaven, You're there. If I make my bed in the grave, behold, You're there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there Your hand shall lead me, and Your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall fall on me, even the night shall fall about me, indeed the darkness shall not hide from You, but the night shines as the day. The darkness and light are both alike to You. Verse 13, for You formed... Oh, well, thank You so much. You're a good man. You're anticipating. You'll go far. Verse 13. For You have formed my inward parts. You have covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise You, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are Your works, and that my soul knows very well. My frame was not hidden from You. When I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth, Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed. Before He was made, God knew who He was. And in Your book, they are all written, the days fashioned for me, when as yet there were none of them. Before David had lived, God had fashioned out his life for Him. What does all this mean? What does all this tell us? It indicates that God is a God of precise thinking, of precision. God's not haphazard. He's not helter-skelter. He doesn't let things just happen to us. If we're right with God, if we're in faith, if we do the things that are pleasing to God, God can orchestrate things to work out in our benefit. God can take care of us. He says He will. If we stay close to God, He can bring about so the right people can be in the right place at the right time for our benefit. Have you ever heard the expression, he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time? How many detective stories have you seen where the police cruiser goes careening down the road, the lights are on, the sirens are going. All of a sudden you see this young man running down the road, and they pull over in front of him and say, "All right, spread him." They spread his hands, they pat him down, put handcuffs on him, and lock him up. Only to find out later that he was about the same height, wearing about the same clothes as somebody who had just robbed a convenience store two blocks away, and he happened to be in the proximity. He was at the wrong place at the wrong time. God can help you be at the right place at the right time, and He can put the right people in your life to do the right things to help you. I know when I was a kid, about 11 or 12 years old, living in Dundee, New York, I was out playing in the backyard, making snowballs. My neighbor was Irene. She was 2 years older than I was, and she was always getting me in trouble. Well, this one night, we're throwing snowballs. It's getting dark. We're throwing snowballs at each other, wailing them back and forth. All of a sudden, she packs this big snowball, and she throws it against the back door of this elderly couple. Mr. Parker and his sister, Ms. Parker, were in their, probably their 80s. He had Alzheimer's. He could hardly get out of bed. I hardly ever saw him. And poor Miss Parker, she walked like this, and that snowball smashed against the door. It reverberated. I saw the light come on. And Mrs. Parker's struggling to get to the door, and she rattles the doorknob and starts open the door. Irene was gone. I stood there because I didn't do anything wrong. I wasn't going to get in trouble. I thought I was fine because I didn't throw the snowball. I was wrong. Tommy Cooper, I'm going to tell your mother on you, and you're going to be punished. So I thought, what's this little old lady going to do? She told my mother and I was punished, and I didn't do anything. I was at the wrong place at the wrong time. But God can make sure that He puts the right people in the right place at the right time for us. One wintry evening, we were on a church visit in northwestern Pennsylvania. And for any of you that have traveled down there, some of those roads are very windy, steep hills, forest going up the mountainside one way, cliff going down the other. Well, I was traveling with the minister. He was going a little faster than maybe the conditions would allow. All of a sudden, saw the lights of a Pennsylvania state trooper. We pulled over. Trooper pulled over about probably 40 or 50 yards back because there really wasn't any room to pull over. There was barely enough room now for cars to come by. Police officer comes up to the car, taps on the window. Minister rolls down his window, and he always had this habit of carrying his ministerial credentials right next to his license. So when he flipped them open, he thought that would get him a little leeway. Well, it worked. The guy said, "Well, sir, I'm sorry. You're speeding. I'll give you warning this time, but please take heed because these roads are icy and there's been a couple accidents reported up ahead earlier on." The window went back up and I turned around and looked. There was no car. There was no policeman. There was nothing. Now keep in mind, cliff on one side, hill on the other side. There were no crossroads. There were no driveways. There were no homes. There were no wide spots in the road for him to turn around. Within 2 seconds, he was gone. I bumped the minister and I said, I think that was an angel. He turned around and looked, couldn't believe it. And when I talk to this guy to this day, he's still certain there was an angel there. Because not 5 minutes down the road, had we been maintaining the speed that we were going, we might have lost control. Because at a much reduced rate, we took a curve, there was some black ice, and that car started to fishtail a little bit. It wasn't a problem, but it could have been a serious problem if he'd been speeding. So God puts the right people. Now, okay, if we're doubting it was an angel, he had the right person at the right place at the right time. So my point's made either way. Another situation, when Pam and I and our children moved to San Antonio, I left Buffalo. I'd had a painting business, and the economy tanked in Buffalo, so our house took a year or so for our house to sell. We needed to go to San Antonio because business was good down there. I talked to a fella in the church. He came up to me and asked me what I did. And I told him, he says, well, hey, they're starting a new department in the roofing company that I work for. And I've been named a superintendent. Would you be interested? And I'm going, well, yeah, kind of. He says, well, it's a handyman department. What they're going to do is they're going to advertise, and they're going to be in a 24-hour emergency thing. If somebody gets broken into, they'll put the plywood up and paint the door and put a new door on, or you might have a cabinet over here, a window over there. And I'm going, I don't want to do that. I want a whole house to paint. I said, I need to really get a good amount of work. And he pressured me and pressured me, and I kept telling him no. Finally, he called me on the phone about 2 weeks later. He said, Tom, got a whole house for you to paint. Are you interested? I said, yeah. My son and I can come down, and we'll look it over. And so in their office, you go upstairs, there was a contractor's room. And on one wall was these pigeonholes with everybody's name under it. Mine was the last one, the newest guy, way over here to the right. And they had that contract in it. They already estimated, they figured the job. All I had to do was get the material and go do it. But I thought, new company, new handyman department, what good is this going to be? It'll give me one job anyway. Well, I got that job done. Went in on Friday to get my check. There were three more jobs in my box. After 2 years, I had 10 men going because of this new handyman department. It just exploded because the Belden Roofing and Remodeling had a 30-year history of good business in San Antonio, and a lot of the rich people in Alamo Heights and some of the oil-rich areas down there, they would pay three times as much to have something done if they knew they had a dependable company to do it. So it just flourished. God put this guy in my life at the right time, at the right place, and it helped us get a good start when we were in San Antonio. If you don't think God does this, turn over to the book of Acts. Acts chapter 9. You say, well, I don't think God just intervenes. This might be time and chance, or it's a coincidence. I don't think God manipulates people to put them in the right place at the right time. Acts chapter 9. Starting in verse 10. You know the story. Well, let's start right in verse 1. I'll read it. Then Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked letters from him to the synagogues of Damascus, so that if he found any who were of the way, this way, the way we live, the way we operate, any Christians, anybody that followed Jesus Christ, Paul wanted to be able to take him back to Jerusalem bound. Verse 3, and as he journeyed, he came near Damascus, and suddenly a light shone around him from heaven. Then he fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to him, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Paul said, who are you, Lord? And the Lord said, I am Jesus, who you are persecuting me. Isn't it hard for you to kick against the goads? Verse 6, so he, trembling and astonished, said, Lord, what do you want me to do? And the Lord said unto him, arise and go into the city, and you will be told what you must do. The men who journeyed with him stood speechless, hearing a voice, but seeing no one. Then Saul arose from the ground, and when his eyes were opened, he saw no one. But they led him by the hand and brought him into Damascus. and he was 3 days without sight, neither ate nor drank. Now there was a certain disciple at Damascus named Ananias, and to him the Lord said in a vision, Ananias, and he said, Here I am, Lord. So the Lord said to him, Arise and go to the street called Straight, and inquire at the house of Judas for one called Saul of Tarsus. For behold, he is praying, and in a vision he has seen a man named Ananias coming and putting his hand on him so that he might receive his sight. Then Ananias answered, Lord, I have heard from many about this man, how much harm he has done to your saints in Jerusalem. And here he has the authority from the chief priest to bind all that call on your name. Verse 15, But the Lord said unto him, Go, for he is a chosen vessel of mine to bear my name before the Gentiles, kings, and the children of Israel. For I will show him how many things he must suffer for my name's sake. And Ananias went his way and entered the house, and laying his hands on him, said, Brother Saul, the Lord Jesus, who appeared to you on the road as you came, has sent me, that you may receive your sight and be filled with the Holy Spirit. So here's an example of God putting someone in the right place at the right time. You know, if we ever get to the point where we think God isn't truthful, where God said, I'll never leave you or forsake you, and if our troubles get to the point where we think God's forsaken us, and that God moved, maybe it's us that moved. Maybe we're the ones that aren't in the right. Maybe we're the ones that are cutting God's blessings off from us. I want to read this poem. I'm sure you've all heard it. It's called Footsteps in the Sand. One night a man had a dream. He dreamed he was walking along on the beach with the Lord. Across the sky, flash scenes from his life. For each scene, he noticed two sets of footprints in the sand, one belonging to him and the other to the Lord. When the last scene of his life flashed before him, he looked back at the footprints in the sand. He noticed that many times along the path of his life, there was only one set of footprints. He also noticed that it happened at the very lowest and saddest times of his life. This really bothered him, and he questioned the Lord about it. Lord, you said that once I decided to follow you, you'd walk with me all the way. But I have noticed that during the most troublesome times in my life, there was only one set of footprints. I don't understand. Why, when I needed you the most, would you leave me? The Lord replied, My son, my precious child, I love you and would never leave you. During your times of trial and suffering, when you see only one set of footprints, it was then that I carried you. So God doesn't leave us. He doesn't forsake us. But as I am advancing in this elderly state, I find it harder to do some of the jobs that I used to find as very easy to do. And had my granddaughter, who's with us today, with me, it's been a couple years ago, and we were working on this one house, and all of the job was paint the outside trim. I got around to one side, and I didn't even notice that there was an eaves that went back, I'd say about 10 feet. Had to paint the fascia and the soffit. Everything else was stucco. But it was over this red clay tile. And I thought, 225 pounds, I get on that clay tile, if I crack one, it's right where the neighbors can look down at the roof, so it wouldn't be a very good idea. And I stood there deliberating. Well, I took my granddaughter on the job just so she could help straighten out the truck, keep me company, bring me tools, one thing or another. And I got to thinking, yes, if I'm going to pay her, I'm going to have her do something. So I gave her a brush and a bucket of paint and told her to go paint the downspouts in the back because it's basically the same color. I thought, if it doesn't cover, it's something easier I can do. And I went and she did it quickly. She didn't get it on the stucco. It looked nice. I thought, well, give her something else to do. So I'm here at the ladder deliberating if I am going to step out on that clay tile and walk up on that. And she comes along and she says, Pops, you want me to do that? I kind of chuckled because her mother used to do that as a little girl. If I had a jar I couldn't open or something, and here her mother was 4 or 5 years old at the time, I'm standing there struggling, and she goes, "Dad, you want me to do that?" I'm going, "Yeah, like you're going to do it." And I kind of chuckled at Lorraine at first, and I thought, wait a minute. 110 pounds up, I'd rather have her 110 pounds up there and me hold the ladder than my 220 pounds up there and her 110 pounds holding the ladder. I says, "Well, here, why don't you try it?" So she gets up there. I bring the bucket and the paint. I hand it to her. She puts the brush in her mouth. She works her way back, paints it quickly, looked good. This isn't giving you a raise, by the way. I could see the dollar signs just going in her head here. And she did well. And then there's two more peaks like that, so I figured, well, have her do them. So she did them. Just before we came down here, about a month ago, a lady called me, wanted me to bid just the front of her house. It was a high-dollar area, probably a $500,000 home. And all she wanted was the front of the house painted. And she was a lawyer. Her husband was a surgeon. She said, "Just drive by, take a look at it, and give me a call." Well, I pulled up. It was at a circular drive cul-de-sac, and I looked at it, and I go, oh, no. Metal roof, fairly steep pitch. On the top of the second story was another peak, but it was set back far enough that a 40-foot ladder wouldn't even reach it. And I thought, how am I going to get that? And I thought, there's two options. I could rent a lift, or I knew another contractor that would lend me a guy for a day, and he could do it. But it would be high dollar for him and the coordinating problems, one thing or another. So I figured in enough extra to put a lift up. But then I realized that the flower arrangements and the way the sidewalk was and all that, that might not work. I have a theory in my business of always tackling one of the hardest things first. And then another theory is chip away at everything that doesn't look like an elephant, and when you're done, you have an elephant. So I decided, I gave her a price, she accepted it, we started it, and all the time, every place we're working, I'm looking at that peak trying to figure out, how on earth am I going to get this peak? Why am I so stupid as to name my dog Jesus? Why did I take this job? So I was all ready to call the contractor to let the other guy come over the next day, but it looked like it might be rainy the next day, so it was going to create a big problem. I'm looking up there, and Lorena goes, "I think I can get it, Pops." Okay. I wasn't going to argue with her. We put the 40-foot ladder up. She put clamps on the standing seams, stepped over the roof, turned around, scooched her way back, put a brush in her sweatshirt, put the bail of the paint can in her mouth, worked her way back, and kept putting the clamps on. This pitch of a roof like that, it was like a super slide. If any of you ever been on a super slide, if she didn't have those clamps on those seams, she'd have slid right off the roof. She got up there, she did the whole thing flawlessly. And the lady was amazed, everybody was happy. We're driving home one day, and she said, "Pops, did you ever think when I was little that when I got older, I'd be the one that was helping you when you couldn't do some of these jobs?" And I'm thinking to myself, there's a making for a good message in there. God puts the right people in the right place at the right time. Turn, if you would, to the book of Mark. Yeah, I could go on and on and on about other stories, things that have happened to us. And so could you, probably. If you think back of situations or individuals that have crossed your path just out of the blue that helped you out of a certain situation. Another fact on that roof, I had the 28-foot ladder up, or 40-foot ladder up, three-quarter extended. Years ago, I could pick that thing up and move it. Anymore, it takes two men and a horse. I can't move it because my shoulder's bad. We had it positioned. Then there was a porch that jutted out. And after she got the one part of it done, we needed to move it over on the other side for something. And I'm thinking, I'm going to have to take this whole thing down, move it all the way out, struggle to get it over here and back up. Just at that time, two guys for the irrigation thing, the sprinkler system came in. Guy looked at me kind of perplexed. He says, "Sir, would you like some help moving that?" I said, "You bet I would." He moved the ladder for me. Just like, and I'm thinking, this is amazing. They were there for, what, half an hour? Just in time to move the ladder. So God puts the right people, the right place, the right time. Mark 14. Verse 12. This is for the skeptic that thinks God doesn't meddle in our affairs. Verse 12, chapter 14 of Mark. "Now on the first day of unleavened bread, when they killed the Passover lamb, his disciples said unto him, 'Where do you want us to go and prepare that you may eat the Passover?' So he sent out two of his disciples and said to them, 'Go into the city, and a man will meet you carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him. And wherever he goes in, say to the master of the house, the teacher says, where is the guest room in which I may eat the Passover with my disciples? Then he will show you a large upper room furnished and prepared. There, make ready for us.' And his disciples went out and came into the city and found it just as he had said to them, and they prepared the Passover." God can put people in the right place at the right time to help you out. And sometimes it's not just people. I've got a story here. I've read this over several times and can probably give you the gist of it, but I want to read it because it's poignant the way some of the phraseology is. It's called The Old Man and the Dog. You may have heard it, but it's good for a review. "Watch out, you nearly broadsided that car," my father yelled at me. "Can't you do anything right?" Those words hurt worse than blows. I turned my head toward the elderly man in the seat beside me, daring me to challenge him. A lump rose in my throat as I averted my eyes. I wasn't prepared for another battle. "I saw the car, Dad. Please don't yell at me while I'm driving." My voice was measured and steady, sounding far calmer than I really felt. Dad glared at me, turned away, and settled back. At home, I left Dad in front of the television and went outside to collect my thoughts. Dark, heavy clouds hung in the air with a promise of rain. The rumble of distant thunder seemed to echo my inner turmoil. What could I do about him? Dad had been a lumberjack in Washington and Oregon. He enjoyed being outdoors and reveled in pitting his strength against the forces of nature. He had endured grueling lumberjack competitions and had placed often. The shelves in his house were filled with trophies that attested to his prowess. The years marched on relentlessly. The first time he couldn't lift a heavy log, he joked about it. But later that same day, I saw him outside alone, straining to lift it. He became irritable when anybody teased him about his advancing age. Oh, by the way, you're not going to get irritable, are you? Okay. He became irritable about anyone teasing of his advancing age. 4 days after his 67th birthday, he had a heart attack. An ambulance sped him to the hospital, where a paramedic administered CPR to keep blood and oxygen flowing. At the hospital, Dad was rushed into an operating room. He was lucky. He survived. But something inside Dad had died. His zest for life was gone. He obstinately refused to follow doctor's orders. Suggestions and offers of help were turned aside with sarcasm and insult. The number of visitors thinned and finally stopped altogether. Dad was left alone. My husband Dick and I asked Dad to come live with us on our small farm. We'd hoped the fresh air and rustic atmosphere would help him adjust. Within a week after he moved in, I regretted the invitation. It seemed nothing was satisfactory. He criticized everything I did. I became frustrated and moody. Soon I was taking my pent out anger on Dick, and we began to bicker and argue. Alarmed, Dick sought out our pastor and explained the situation. The clergyman set up weekly counseling appointments for us. At the close of each session, he prayed, asking God to soothe Dad's troubled mind. But the months wore on, and God was silent. Something had to be done, and it was up to me to do it. The next day, I sat down with a phone book and methodically called each of the mental health clinics listed in the Yellow Pages. I explained my problem to each of the sympathetic voices that answered in vain. Just when I was giving up hope, one of the voices suddenly exclaimed, "I just read something that might help you. Let me go get the article." I listened as she read. The article described a remarkable study done at a nursing home. All of the patients were under treatment for chronic depression. Yet their attitudes had improved dramatically when they were given a responsibility to take care of a dog. I drove to the animal shelter that afternoon. After I filled out a questionnaire, a uniformed officer led me to the kennels. The odor of disinfectant stung my nostrils as I moved down the rows of pens. Each contained 5 to 7 dogs. Long-haired dogs, curly-haired dogs, black dogs, spotted dogs, white dogs, all jumped up trying to reach me. I studied each one but rejected one after the other for various reasons. Too big, too small, too much hair. As I neared the last pen, a dog in the shadows of the far corner struggled to his feet, walked to the front of the run, and sat down. It was a pointer, one of the dog world's aristocrats. But this was just a caricature of the breed. Years had etched his face and muzzle with shades of gray. His hip bones jutted out in lopsided triangles, but it was his eyes that caught and held my attention. Calm, clear, they beheld me unwaveringly. I pointed to the dog. "Can you tell me about him?" The officer looked and shook his head in puzzlement. "He's a funny one. Appeared out of nowhere. Sat in front of the gate. We brought him in, figuring someone would be right down to claim him. But that was 2 weeks ago, and we've heard nothing. His time is up tomorrow." As the word sank in, I turned to the man in horror. "You mean you're going to kill him?" "Ma'am," he said gently, "that's our policy. We don't have room for every unclaimed dog." I looked at the pointer again. The calm brown eyes awaited my decision. "I'll take him," I said. I drove home with the dog on the front seat beside me. When I reached the house, I honked the horn twice. I was helping my prize out of the car when Dad shuffled onto the front porch. "Ta-da! Look what I got for you, Dad," I said excitedly. Dad looked, wrinkled up his face in disgust. If I'd wanted a dog, I'd have gotten one. And I'd have picked out a better specimen than that bag of bones. "Keep it. I don't want it." Dad waved his iron scornfully and went back into the house. Anger arose inside me. It squeezed together my throat muscles and pounded into my temples. "You better get used to him, Dad. He's staying." Dad ignored me. "Did you hear me, Dad?" I screamed. At those words, Dad whirled around angrily, his hands clenched at his side, his eyes narrowed and blazing with hate. We stood glaring at each other like duelists. When suddenly the pointer pulled free from my grasp, he wobbled up toward my dad, sat down in front of him, and slowly, carefully raised his paw. Dad's lower jaw trembled as he stared at the uplifted paw. Confusion replaced the anger in his eyes. The pointer waited patiently. Then all of a sudden, Dad was on his knees, hugging the animal. It was the beginning of a warm, intimate friendship. Dad named the pointer Cheyenne. Together, he and Cheyenne explored the community. They spent long hours walking down dusty lanes. They spent reflective moments on the bank of streams, angling for tasty trout. They even started to attend church services together, Dad sitting in the pew, Cheyenne lying quietly at his feet. Dad and Cheyenne were inseparable for the next 3 years. Dad's bitterness faded. He and Cheyenne made many, many friends. Then late one night, I was startled to feel Cheyenne's cold nose burrowing through our bed covers. He'd never before come into our bedroom at night. I woke Dick, put on my robe, and ran into my father's room. Dad lay in his bed, his face serene, but his spirit had left quietly sometime during the night. 2 days later, my shock and grief deepened when I discovered Cheyenne laying dead beside Dad's bed. I wrapped his still form in the rag rug he had slept on. As Dick and I buried him near a favorite fishing hole, I silently thanked the dog for the help he had given me in restoring Dad's peace of mind. The morning of Dad's funeral dawned, overcast and dreary. This day looks like the way I feel, I thought, as I walked down the aisle to the pews reserved for our family. I was surprised to see the many, many friends that Dad and Cheyenne had made filling the church. The pastor began his eulogy. It was a tribute to both Dad and the dog who had changed his life. And then the pastor turned to Hebrews 13:2, "Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by this some had entertained angels without knowing it." And then the pastor said, "I've often thanked God for sending that angel." Then the lady says, "For me, the past dropped into place, completing a puzzle that I had not seen before. The sympathetic voice that had just read the article, Cheyenne's unexpected appearance at the animal shelter, his calm acceptance and complete devotion to my father, the proximity of their deaths, and I suddenly understood, I knew that God had answered my prayers after all." Now, the moral they want you to get is life is too short for drama and petty things, so laugh hard, love truly, forgive quickly. Live while you are alive. Forgive now those who made you cry. You might not get a second chance. And if you don't send this to at least 10 people, your computer's going to implode. The moral I would like you to get is God can put the right people in the right places at the right time. And He can even do it with animals. He can do it however He wants to help us. Turn over to the book of Kings, 2 Kings chapter 8. Starting in verse 1. "Then Elisha spoke to the woman whose son he had restored to life." You know, you remember the story. There was a famine. Elisha needed a place to go, so he went in to stay with the Shunammite woman and said, "Here, put me up. God said to come to you." And she goes, "Hey, I haven't got anything to eat." But what little she had lasted. Her son died. Elisha raised him to life. God, through Elisha, raised him up. So, verse 1 starting out, "Then Elisha spoke to the woman whose son he had restored to life, saying, 'Arise and go, you and your household, and sojourn wherever you can sojourn, for the Lord has called for a famine, and furthermore, it'll come upon the land for 7 years. You're not going to be able to survive where you are. You're going to have to get out of here.' So the man of God told the lady, 'Take off, go find a place to live where you can sustain yourself and your child.'" Verse 2, "So the woman arose and did according to the saying of the man of God. And she went with her household and sojourned in the land of the Philistines 7 years. And it came to pass, verse 3, at the end of 7 years, that the woman returned from the land of the Philistines, and she went to make an appeal to the king for her house and her land." Good luck. How many of you have ever had to deal with the municipality and all the red tape and the bureaucracy over anything to do with land? Easements, boundaries, anything. Can you imagine leaving your house right now for 7 years, being gone, and come back, somebody's taken over, they've mowed the yard, they fed the livestock, they've raised the grain, they've sold it, and you want your land back? What are the chances? Probably not very good. And they probably weren't very good back then either. But look what happened. Now, you have to remember, God apparently found favor with a Shunammite woman because she took care of Elisha. He raised her dead child. He allowed her to get out of the famine in the land and be gone, and she was preserved. But it came to pass at the end of 7 years, she wanted her land back. In verse 4, "Then the king," at the same time she was going in, the king happened to be, coincidence, talking to Gehazi. Now Gehazi was the servant to Elisha. And the king said, "I've heard a lot of wonderful things about this man. Could you tell me more?" We'll pick it up verse 4 again. The king talked with Gehazi, the servant of the man of God, saying, tell me, please, all the great things Elisha has done. Now it happened, as he was telling the king how he had restored the dead to life, that there was this woman whose son he had restored to life, appealing to the king for her house and her land. And Gehazi said, my lord, O king, this is the woman, and this is her son whom Elisha has restored to life. In verse 6, when the king asked the woman, she told him, yes, this is the one that Elisha restored to life. So the king appointed a certain officer for her, saying, restore all that was hers and all the proceeds of the field from the day she left the land until now. Was it a coincidence that the servant of Elisha was there talking to the king at the very time the lady came back wanting her land back? I think not. I think God orchestrated it. So Gehazi was there. Gehazi could tell the king of all the wonderful things Elisha had done. And the king was in the frame of mind just to give her the land back. God can put the right people in the right place at the right time. I was going over some of these things in the church in Waco. And afterwards, man come up to me with tears in his eyes. And he said, you know, you brought tears to my eyes in the sermon. And I said, Gary, why is that? He said, this week was the worst week of my life. He said, my wife and I were having problems. Nothing was going right. He said, I started to pack my suitcase. I was going to get out of the house for a couple of days. And the phone rang. And it was Gary Petty. He said, now, Mr. Petty's never called me. Because that church had been under Austin and then was under with Dallas for a while, and Mr. Petty would go up and visit on Sabbath, but as far as just giving him a personal call out of the blue, he had never done it. And they talked for about a half an hour, and he told me, you know, by the time I was through talking to Mr. Petty, I felt good and I'm here at church. If Mr. Petty hadn't called, I probably wouldn't have been at church this week. And I said, well, it just goes to show you, God puts the right people in the right place at the right time. And then a lady told me that when she was younger, her and her husband lived near one of the waterways down near Corpus. And she was sitting next to her son, who was probably 55 years old. And she said, when Matt was just a young boy, less than 2 years old, he liked to run away and get away from me, and he ran out across the street, and he was headed right toward the drop-off that would go into this waterway. He said a car came up, somebody reached out, grabbed him, sent him to the right way, and by the time they looked up, there was no car there. She said, I told two people this early on, and everybody laughed at me. She said, I am so glad you brought this up with some of the examples you had given, because I knew what I saw. And I also knew that there was nobody there just a second later. So God does that for us. God puts the right people in the right place at the right time. Getting ready to move to San Antonio. Pam had a household sale. Sold a lot of the things out. Refrigerators, stoves, things went. Furniture. Everything was going pretty well. And one evening, a man showed up, and he was looking at certain things, and he noticed that the door was open to the garage, I guess, and the boat was out there. And he said, I didn't see your boat advertised. I guess Pam had told him, we had discussed. I was already in San Antonio. Pam was alone with the children. In fact, the children weren't even there this one particular night. There was a church function. And Pam said, we didn't advertise the boat because my husband couldn't make up his mind whether he wanted to take the boat with us or leave it. And she said, are you interested? He goes, yes, let me take a look at it. Looks all around, found out what she was asking for it, and said, well, I'd really like to take it, but I want to take it out in the lake. I don't want to buy a boat without running it, and that's logical. But my wife wasn't about to let him take off with the boat. So I told her later, I says, maybe, you know, if the guy had a son, he could have left his firstborn son and taken the boat. But then I happened to think, you know, the way kids are today sometimes, he might have rather wanted the boat and left the kid, and then we'd been stuck with the kid. But She held her ground. She was not going to let that boat out. He had his checkbook out. He had it made out. He hadn't signed the check yet. And all of a sudden, Pam turned around, and there were two men standing in the kitchen. She said, "Can I help you?" And she said, "I had an ease about it. It didn't startle me, but no one was there to answer the door to let them in." And they said, "We're here to buy the boat. Not we're here to discuss buying the boat. Not that we're here to look at the boat. We're here to buy the boat." And Pam said, "How did you know there was a boat? We never advertised it." They evaded the question and just reinforced that they were there to buy the boat. So our potential buyers sitting there going, "Hey, wait a minute. I'm first. I want to buy the boat." So he signs the check, hands it to Pam, not taking it out to the lake, drives out. He hadn't even gotten the boat hooked up to his truck, and Pam went to talk to the guys. There were no guys. There was nobody there. We had a long driveway. There was nobody in the driveway, nobody walking out the driveway. It was dark by this time. There were no lights where the people were going. They were gone. Pam thinks they might have been an angel. I think they could have been too. If not, God put the right people in the right place at the right time. Like I said, I don't know of any of your stories, but I'm sure if you think over your life, there's been times when people have been put in your life to help you out of a situation, to encourage you, to strengthen you, to kick your butt if that's what was necessary. God will put the right people in the right place at the right time for you. It's been a pleasure being here. Enjoy the rest of your Sabbath.